The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A tremendous amount of human suffering comes from comparisons, comparing ourselves to ideals. We don't live up to ideals. We do live up to them, and now everyone else should. Other people are not living up to them. Comparing ourselves to people, compare themselves to each other. Sometimes the comparison is that I'm not as much X as someone else. Someone else says that I'm more you than you, like the letter U. And then people, a tremendous amount of suffering when those that's projected on other people, that people are somehow wrong and bad because of something about them, because they're old, and people is ageism, and people who are older will often comment on how they're now ignored or not treated well, or sometimes they're treated, ways that they wish they weren't, because they're seen in some kind of category of being old and incapable, and people are treating them in a certain way. People, because of their size, there's comparison. People, their hair, color of the hair, length of hair, kind of hair, skin color, ethnicity, all kinds of things that people do to compare each other, and make judgments about the value of one over another. We compare ourselves to who we were before. Before I was young, and now I'm not. And I wish I had been young, or still young, or now I'm not as Z as I was before. Whatever Z stands for, I'm not as, now I'm wrinkled. And think, in our, beautiful people don't have any wrinkles whatsoever. I grew up with a friend of my parents, a woman who apparently never smiled because she was attempting not to get any wrinkles. But what about the suchness of the human being? What about your suchness? Is there such a thing where you can be held up like a flower and you're allowed just to be as you are in the perfection of suchness, in the simplicity of suchness, without any comparisons at all? What's the beauty of each of us, of each of you? In what way are you a flower? In what way are you perfect, wonderful, as you are? And is that valuable? Is that somehow sentimental or Pollyannish or not really realistic, because we should be comparing ourselves, or those comparisons are real, or they're not real, but they're imposed on me. The world around me is constantly making comparisons, and I'm not safe in the world because of what people are doing and their comparisons against me. And so, to emphasize the suchness of us, maybe that just allows the status quo to be there. And the status quo is harmful. Is that the case? Or is there some way, valuable way, where we can appreciate our own suchness? Can we gaze upon ourselves in such a way that the gaze does not have any comparative thinking? We're not compared to before, to after, to even ideals, even wonderful ideals, where we're not compared to other people. It's just the simplicity of who we are, in a way that maybe we allow the flower to be itself. Now, it's possible in the course of flowers, being flowers, and maybe beginning to kind of gather its forces together to focus on making seeds, that a wind comes along and it blows off the petal. Now we have something new in this world that kind of maybe wasn't as clear as before. Now we have the suchness of the petal. And the petal is just allowed to be itself. And it's kind of beautiful, a petal, just itself. Another option is to look at the flower that's still here and believe that the essence of a flower that we have to maintain at all costs are the petals, all the petals. And if a flower loses a petal, it's no longer perfect. It's no longer right. But is that the case? In the natural course of things, the petals fall off, a seed is made. Why do we carry with us the idea of the perfectly full in blossom flower with all its petals is the only suchness of the flower? Can't it be that as it begins to lose its petals, that it's just as much a suchness as when it was before? This rose that came from the here at the grounds of IMC is already withering up. I can't maybe see it here, but some of the petals are kind of beginning to curl up and turn brown and probably going to fall off soon. And it's possible to see it as being starting to become ugly. It's possible. But is there a way of seeing this that is seeing it neither as ugly or as beautiful, just the suchness of it? Or is it possible to see beauty in its decay? After all, it's just the natural process in which it takes. The suchness of it all, everything, maybe it's beautiful. Maybe everything is beautiful in its suchness. Maybe wrinkles are beautiful. I've seen people with exquisite face full of cobweb wrinkles. And it, literally, I thought, wow, that is beautiful. There's something special about it. And I've seen people with just a little bit of wrinkles. Wow, that's beautiful. And I've seen faces with no wrinkles. Wow, that's beautiful. Why not see it all as beautiful? Why do we have these judgments, these comparisons, these ideas? Now, if we take a flower, let's take another one. Let's take this one. And we single one part of the flower out as being the most important part of the flower, as being the thing that really counts. And we're going to protect that at all costs. We're going to be upset if it's not there anymore. And maybe for this flower, what's most important is that it has it's supported by these beautiful green leaves. But then someone comes along and takes it, or it falls off. And, but that's what made the flower a flower. Or maybe it's a long stem. Maybe the length of a stem, the more longer it is what makes a flower a successful flower. But then, somehow or other, the flower is made smaller. Oh no. Shorter. Oh no. I was so attached to it being long. That's what really made it a flower. And then the petals start falling off. And the people who thought that petals were the essence, the most important part of the flower. And let's glue it back on. You know, they sell petals at the local craft store. And, you know, it's important to make the flower perfect. So let's go buy some other petals and glue them on when they're falling off. These are all kind of silly examples, but Don't we do this to ourselves? Aren't we judging ourselves and selecting parts of ourselves out as being what's important and what needs to be held up and made to be the way it is? But aren't we innocent in doing this, comparisons? Or maybe, isn't it inevitable we do this when the world around us is doing it? The social world, the people, the advertisements, they're all doing it. And they're all holding up a certain way that's supposed to be the ideal and the right way. And then people behave that way. And people do judge each other. And if they're judging each other, they might judge me. And if they're judging me, then I don't feel safe. And so I better figure out the right length of hair that an acceptable person is supposed to have. I better figure out the right something and this and that. And people do make adjustments to themselves. And, you know, people, I know people like myself have moved between cultures. And then there were different standards. And then you kind of figure out, like, how do I fit in here? And what is expected? And what clothes? And what ways of speaking? And what ways of being? And all kinds of things. And so, once we get involved in this complicated social world, it's sometimes difficult not to be pulled into this world of selecting parts out of the whole. And maybe it's reason to protest. Maybe it's reason to stand up and point these kinds of terrible things out that goes on. But what about the suchness? Is that going to be eclipsed? Does that never have a place? Is there a time and place where we can appreciate the suchness of ourselves, of the flower, of the situation? The suchness of a moment in time? Or are we always on that treadmill that keeps going on and on of the mind involved in the activity of comparative thinking? The mind involved in not seeing the simplicity of the moment, seeing how much suchness is here in some wonderful way. The treadmill is that kind of going and going and going, churning away, thinking, wondering. And I think sometimes meditators, especially when they begin, or maybe when they, I don't know, can happen any time. It's possible to be in awe at the treadmill in which the mind is just thinking and comparison and stories and ideas and concerns, and just like the thoughts just keep going and going. But it's not necessary to live that way all the time. Just like it's important to eat meals or to eat, it's usually not a good idea to eat nonstop. But the mind somehow can go nonstop, just churning away. And even if some of that churning and thinking and reflection is important, does it need to be all continuous? And so we come to meditation, I think, not just to calm ourselves down, but it's possible to come to meditation to come to gaze upon the suchness of ourselves, which I'd like to propose is beautiful. To be able to gaze upon the beauty of who we are, which is that which is most natural about being a human being. What is that? This rose which is decaying, turning brown, is in the suchness of it all, I would say I look upon it with a certain reverence and beauty as it ages and gets brown. Of course it will. Why does beauty only reside in the full kind of peak vitality of the rose. And one of the fascinating and important ways in which suchness can be seen is with a mind that is not caught up in unskillful states of mind. A mind that's not caught up in these comparisons that are driven by fear, ill will, greed, vanity, conceit, jealousy. Now, the whole spectrum of kind of ways in which we get caught in the mind that's tense and contracted and attached to something, that's selecting something out of the whole as being what's important. And some idea that it has to be a particular way. The mind that can see suchness is the mind that is not caught in all these mental states of attachment. And that is a beautiful mind. That's a mind that's as beautiful as looking out across the, here in California from the beach, the ocean view, looking out across the ocean and seeing the beauty of the ocean. Looking at Half Dome in Yosemite, or looking down into the Grand Canyon, or looking up into the night sky and seeing the constellations and stars. There are times when we look at the natural world and we're in awe and it's beautiful. But to look into our own mind, to look into our own being and be as marvel with that as much as we would at the world, at the universe, the world outside. To be able to see our mind as being, they should probably make it protect a national monument. Or maybe each of us that maybe that's where the next time the Park Service kind of makes a national park, it should be the suchness of everyone's minds. The mind that does not caught up in these concepts and comparative thinking. I mean, it's a phenomenally beautiful thing, this mind, this heart. And to see the world with that beautiful mind, that beautiful heart, allows us then to see the suchness of people, suchness of other people, their beauty as they are. We look at the rose that's decaying, and it's a beautiful rose. Maybe we want to bow down to the rose. It's so beautiful. We have a reverence and care. The ability to see the beauty, see the suchness of things. I've been at the bedside of someone who had died, and it was profoundly beautiful in the suchness of it. Is it okay to say that? Probably I'd be careful to say that if the relatives are all quite upset and grieving and whatever. I might not say it then, but is there something about seeing everything in this life except those things that are driven by hatred, driven by greed, driven by delusion or attachment? Do they belong to the world of suchness? In some ways they do. But they are born from an inability to appreciate the suchness of life. They are born from a mind that doesn't see the beauty of itself. They're born from hearts that are withered and contracted and in pain. And so they don't have the ability to touch into or be resting in or be grounded in this beautiful quality of our life. Everything is beautiful when they are free. of greed, hatred, and delusion. But a lot of it depends on how your mind is, the ability to see it. So if we're looking out and expecting to see the beauty and suchness and appreciate that in the world without somehow finding it in ourselves, it's probably not so stable or so accurate or something. So meditation, Buddhist meditation, is a way of coming into ourselves to set ourselves free of our attachments, our clinging, not so that we just are, I don't know, detached, but so that we can appreciate and see the beautiful suchness of this world where there's no clinging, no grasping, no hatred. And then we can start kind of being the suchness. There is a acting, living in the world from the suchness, with the suchness. What's that like? It's a life which is free, free of attachment. So for me, this whole movement of mindfulness and meditation is such a phenomenally wonderful thing we're doing. Something I almost have, you know, kind of a deep reverence for, like I do for the night sky, looking into the amazement of it, or beautiful scenery in the natural world, or taking the time to walk in a garden and see the flowers and appreciate each flower for itself, or take the time to see a hummingbird and the incandescent color and the flittering around. It's so beautiful. It takes time to stop and appreciate the suchness of our mind, the suchness of the world. And then we're available to live a wiser life. Because of what a wonderful thing to live a life that comes out of that recognition of suchness, recognition of beauty, that is so easily overlooked in ourselves and others in this world. And it's overlooked when our attention becomes excessively selective. It's only about how long the stem is. It's only about the full complement of petals are there. It's only about some aspect of it that we hold on to. This is what it's about. This is who I have to be. This is what I'm about. There is a few mentions in the ancient teachings of the Buddha of people who are just such, the suchness of themselves. And one of them, which maybe is a little bit interpretive, but there's a the Buddha most frequently refers to himself as not as the Buddha, not as his given name, Gautama, but he refers to himself as the Tathagata. And it's an ancient title that probably preceded the Buddha. No one quite knows what it means, but it's a compound of two words, but they don't quite know which two words because of how the compound words and letters kind of merge. But my favorite interpretation of it is that it means the one who is thus. The Buddha is the one who is thus. The one who is such, like such. So imagine that, you know, you go up to the Buddha and he seems like an unusual guy. So you ask him, you know, who are you? What are you? What are you about? And you have your notebook out. You're going to write down notes. After all, you don't get to talk to Buddha that often. And he says, I am thus. I am such. I'm the suchness of this. Would you be irritated? Or would you now appreciate, wow, rather than picking and choosing the parts and defining who he is in some particular way, he just is not defining himself. He's just there. And what is apparent? What is there? He's not going to define it any more than the suchness of it. Here's a few quotes of verses. So if you see the selective process that doesn't see the suchness as one that has an opinion about things, a story about things, a view of how things are, then maybe you'll appreciate this poem. One who is attached argues over doctrines. How and with what does one argue with someone unattached? Embracing nothing, rejecting nothing, right here, a person has shaken off all views. So there's a time, sitting in meditation, where it makes a lot of sense to embrace nothing and reject nothing. If what we want to do is to see the fullness, the wholeness of the suchness of this moment. Here's another verse. They aren't enemies to anything seen, heard, or thought out. How in this world could one have assumptions about those who see in this way, whose conduct is open? So people who are not opposed to anything that they see or hear or anything that's thought out, any opinions, if they don't have that, how could you make assumptions about them? How can you define them? And they refers to them as, these are people whose conduct is open. I guess you get what you see. You see how they conduct themselves, how they are in their suchness. And one more. This is the one that one does not construct, prefer, or take up any doctrine. A sage is not led by precepts or religious practices. Is someone who has gone beyond, who does not depend on beliefs. It is someone who is thus. Someone who is thus. So, why did the Buddha hold up a flower? And why did the monk smile? Can you hold yourself up in such a way that you smile in your thusness, your suchness? I certainly hope that you can gaze upon yourself in such a way, be present for you in such a way, with a mind that's quiet enough from its attachments, its fears, its desires, its, so that you can gaze upon this beautiful being that you are in its suchness. And then to look upon others, every other person, with a reverence and care and respect that can come to see the suchness of them as they are. And what a great world it would be if we loved and respected people just as they are, in a world where we don't see through the filter of greed, hatred, and delusion. So thank you very much, my friends and flowers. We've been a bouquet here today, and the individual flowers are just as wonderful in the bouquet as they are apart. May you take your wonderfulness with you through the day. Thank you.